Welcome to this webinar. I am Helen Kane, CEO of OneMSL, and we are super excited to be able to share with you the summary findings of our 2022 MSL Global Survey. So for those of you that are not familiar with the background to the survey, this really is our connection with industry and our desire to understand the current reality for the MSL and the MSL manager and MSL leader, irrespective of country and of region. And this is the third year that we have run this survey, and we will be sharing with you the demographics of the participants shortly. But please know that the data are really important to us because it informs what we do. It helps us make decisions with respect to training and to our offerings. But actually, we do this for you. We do the survey for all of you sat within industry so that you can reflect on the findings and know decide whether or not you want to take action as a result. So it's an important opportunity for you to connect. This is the second survey that we've run, and yesterday we had some really fascinating feedback from attendees who said, "My goodness, you've given us a lot of food for thought." So I will stop babbling and get on with it. I'm delighted to be joined by Kevin Woodhams.
Hey, everyone.
Who is our Chief Learning Officer. We've renamed him our Chief Learning Officer. So Kevin and I have worked together for many years, and Kevin will be monitoring the chat and will be giving commentary as we progress. So why do we do it? I think I've spoken to this really. We are driven by a desire to really maximize the impact of the MSL and the MSL leader in ultimate support of medical objectives. So just a little bit here about methodology. And we use an online platform, formerly Survey Gizmo. We ran the survey for about 2 months, and respondents were invited either through announcements or through personal invitation using LinkedIn and our One community. This slide shows the participants who responded. So you can see that 68% are field-based MSLs. We have some office-based MSLs. And then we were delighted to see that we had about 23% respondents who were in an MSL management role. This slide is an interesting one in that it provides you with a sense of the regional location of our respondents. So we have a nice breadth from across the world. And if we compare these findings with the previous year's findings, which are shown here in red, you can see that there has been a growth in respondents from the LATAM region, from Asia and Oceania, and from Middle East and Russia. We would refer to these regions as the emerging markets, and this is aligned to our understanding of growth of this role within the emerging markets. You will see a reduction in respondents from USA and Canada, and we attribute that to the fact that last year we were able to enter into a partnership with a company in the US who sent the survey out to their database. We weren't able to do that this year, but we would hope to repeat next year. Again, we have a breadth of respondents from different organization sizes. This is very helpful because it allows us to really, if we want to do a deep dive of the findings, we can see are there particular findings, and there was a question around this yesterday, is that because it's a larger organization? And in fact, there wasn't necessarily a relationship. But the MSL, of course, within the larger organization is likely to have a very different experience to the MSL within the smaller organization. Now, we're now starting to sort of get close to the actual findings. But we know that you find these data really interesting. So a question was, what was your role before you became an MSL? And here we see that, in fact, yes, we have people who are entering industry from both healthcare and academia, but more than 50% of MSLs were already in industry before becoming an MSL. So they either were in medical or they moved across into the MSL role from another industry role. And I think that's really important, because it's we know that many organizations want to develop people from within. So this clearly shows that these opportunities are happening and are continuing to happen. Two views here on highest academic qualification. There was a time when really many organizations were being quite clear that they wanted MSLs to have a PhD. And perhaps we're starting to see that this may not necessarily be the case in the findings this year. We're starting to see that fewer MSLs have a PhD. And, you know, I, from a personal perspective, of course, you know, scientific qualifications are essential for the MSL. But I think it's also really important to consider skills in addition to scientific expertise. Skills and mindsets and behaviors are really as important as science. Kevin, is there anything that you would like to comment on around that?
No, I just like to reinforce what you've just said, really. I think that people are noticing that you can learn information, but skills are something completely different. And when we're talking about the variety of external stakeholders that people are mixing with now, and we're talking about it being a much more personal approach to interactions, that skills have become as important as scientific knowledge. And mindset is everything, because the environment is changing all the time. So we're actually looking for people who are prepared to kind of take on that challenge rather than do the same thing in the same way that they've done over time.
Thanks, Kevin. It's also very helpful for us to know the years' experience that respondents have, because you will see, as we share these findings with you, that identified needs are quite different dependent upon where you are in your MSL journey. I hope that makes sense, and I think we'll bring that to life a little bit later. And it was fascinating for us that there was a very similar pattern in terms of total MSL experience in this year's survey compared with our previous survey. Now we get on to the really interesting findings. So who is your direct line manager? And 40% of MSLs have a dedicated line manager, a dedicated MSL manager. So in other words, 60% of our respondents. And you can see here that we had 478 MSLs answered this question. So 60% of those respondents are reporting in to a role that is not dedicated. Into an individual, rather, who has many other responsibilities in addition to MSL manager. And we see the impact, we will see the impact of that in the findings moving forward. And one of the questions yesterday was, it would be interesting to do a correlation between the 40% and the size of the company. And you would almost expect that it was the larger companies who where MSLs had dedicated MSL managers, and the findings actually show that that's not necessarily the case. And when we compare this then with the findings here in 2019, the last survey that we conducted pre-COVID, in fact, we see a slight tail off here in the percentage of MSLs who have a dedicated manager. Always a fascinating question. because we know that MSLs are a very hot property. And we know that for many organizations, they have a goal to attract and retain. So the question that was asked was, what was the reason for leaving your last role? And in fact, this finding was consistent with the previous survey. The reason for leaving was due to lack of development opportunities within that organization. So that has been given as the main reason. And for all of you who are on the line, we're going to ask a poll question around this in a few moments, because we'd be really interested to hear your definition of what might be meant by development opportunities. So before we do that, let's just quickly take a look at the findings from 2019 and 20. And you can see here that, again, lack of development opportunities was cited, but in fact, we're seeing this increase in the percentage of MSLs that left for that reason. So this, I imagine, could be the subject of an entire webinar. I don't know what you think, Kevin, but we will probably look at this as we move forward. Yeah, I'm seeing some comments come in from chat. Is there anything, Kevin, that you want to add at the moment?
So the first one, thank you, Chris, for your question, which is, do you know anything about the geography? Are there more dedicated managers in bigger countries? Actually, there was some correlation, but it wasn't clear. And that may well be because we had a large number of respondents from bigger pharma. What we have noticed is that in markets where the MSL role is actually perhaps newer, you've got less MSLs on the ground covering bigger areas reporting to a person, be that head office role or a dedicated manager. So it's the kind of thing that needs to be explored further, because there doesn't seem to be a pattern. What the pattern that you'll see as we go through the presentation is the knock-on effects of not having dedicated management. And surprisingly, not only when they've got a dedicated manager, because although that's the way the question was answered, anecdotally, we know that no one or very few people actually have the singular role of being a designated manager. Everyone has other responsibilities relating to their TA or whatever. So it's something that we need to look at further. I hope that answers your question, Chris.
Jen, who is not with us today, but who does an amazing job on the analytics of all of these data, Jen thought it would be interesting to look to see whether any regional differences around this answer. And in fact, there are none. So irrespective of region, lack of development opportunities was still the number one answer with respect to the reason for leaving your last role. So you can see that highlighted in the bold text. So this is your opportunity to engage with us. Greg is going to launch a poll shortly, but what we'd like you to tell us is, in thinking about that question that we asked, what does a development opportunity mean to you? Does it mean progression from MSL to senior MSL and executive MSL? Does it mean an opportunity to undertake training courses, a further qualification, or an opportunity to develop your skills within the organization through inclusion in projects or leadership? Fantastic. So can you see the results, Kevin?
I can, absolutely. And as you said, they're quite different to yesterday. So yesterday, we basically had people voting on two of those, which was the progression from MSL to senior MSL, executive MSL, and the opportunity to develop skills within the organisation. And we've got far more in this group today that's talking about the progression of title, if you like. What this makes me think about, particularly this group of results today where we've got so much spread, is that this is a conversation that needs to be had within an organization. So this is the what does it mean here? Because if we look at what happened over the last 2 years, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, actually people were stuck at home with little ability to access their external stakeholders. So lots of organizations put on training courses. We know that because we were involved in them. But the feedback was that actually over time people got trained out, if you like. They were exhausted by the fact of learning. And that might be because actually they don't see training courses as their route to development. It's much more about developing skills. And we'll talk about this again with another part of the survey. What's interesting is this progression thing in terms of title, because it's the how is this organized within an organization? So is this just down to longevity, so time in role, time in tenure, or is this related to changing competencies and different roles and responsibilities? And often I don't think that that's something that's discussed right at the beginning or during the hiring process. Mm-hmm. So if this is what people are looking for, they can easily become frustrated, particularly if they've been doing the MSL role for a while, where this isn't available within any given organization. So I think it's something we need to be talking about more.
I absolutely agree. And Walter, thank you for your comment in chat. Yeah, I agree. It could be up, down, zigzagged, whatever. Mm. It's just an opportunity for a different opportunity, if you like. And, you know, it's really something, you know, we are seeing a pattern here. And as Kevin said, you know, for those of you that are in senior roles, you know, we're just calling this out. You know, this is very much something that if it's not on the agenda for discussion around what are the opportunities that we can create, or even the conversations aren't being had with people as part of their IPD or IDP even, sorry, you know, then that's where frustration can set in. But it's really great to hear from all of you. So thanks. Thank you for that. Next week, we asked a question here about therapy areas and reassuringly, half of MSLs are covering one area. And, you know, if we look at these findings and we think about individuals, potentially two can be achievable, depending, I guess, on the complexity and the size of your region and so on. But realistically, you know, it's a challenge to be an expert in all of the data relating to a drug in development or products for three or more areas. I think that's a massive stretch and could be really quite a challenge for MSLs. This is where I got super excited. So the question here was, where is your drug in the life cycle? And you will see here reflected quite a difference between today and 2 years ago. So these were the findings showing that MSLs certainly are operating or are being active as early as phase one within some organizations. And you can see here that we have 6% at phase one and 14% at phase two. Of course, we would expect to see that MSLs are active at phase three and beyond. But if we compare these findings with 3 years ago, you can see the shift. And this for me is absolutely aligned to the evolving role of the MSL. So the MSL being recognized as this true strategic partner sitting within medical, between R&D and commercial, and the very valuable role that the MSL is able to play, working alongside their colleagues within ClinOps or or R&D. So I think that when we repeat this survey in a couple of years' time, this will indeed be an interesting finding. And in fact, I am aware, and for those of you who are on the line, that there are some organizations now who have got what they call pipeline MSLs. And those are MSLs who are simply working in this early clinical development phase. And those MSLs are different, or have got clearly got a different remit to those who are working in phase three and beyond. I'm seeing there's quite a lot happening in chat, Kevin. Is there anything that we want to think about at this point?
So a comment from Robert, who's basically saying that typically career progression is about competency development impacting role. It was historically tenure. And I commented back to say that I don't think it's always seen that way now. And tenure on its own isn't a good measure of success. And then Maya has just commented that she believes MSL is the best place prior to and shortly post-launch. So she's really happy to see this change. And I think it was one of the things that we were really pleased about when we first saw the data. So, it's nice to kind of see it going back to almost, from my perspective, where it was. And perhaps should be.
Yeah. Maya, it's always great to hear from you. So thank you for your comment and your support. So this, you know, we'll not spend too much time on this. And of course, you know, it's just interesting that not everyone does indeed even have a job description. And we know that very often the job description is not the job that you end up doing. But at least a job description provides a starting point for hiring and assessment. But there are still a number of MSLs who don't have a job description, which clearly, you know, we would often observe in workshops that if we try to get, if we're having a session around purpose, that actually some MSLs struggle to find the words around that. You know, because they're just so busy doing. So, you know, purpose is our why. So working guidance. So the question you can see on the screen. And of course, you know, if you're sat on, you know, on this webinar as someone who works in big pharma, and I know that a number of you do, and you have been there for many, many years, this will just, you might almost be asking yourself, why are we even asking this question? But we've asked this question consistently over 3 years, and the results have been quite surprising. And the reality is that you can see that there are still quite a significant number. So 52 MSLs are working within organizations that are within the absence of having either an SOP or a working guidance document. And we're all familiar with the fact that, you know, we work in a highly regulated industry, and that you can have significant regional variations with respect to what an MSL can and cannot do. And my view on working guidance is that it should enable the MSL to be the most effective they can be in their role. It should not disable the MSL from doing their job. But in the absence of having any kind of working guidance, then I think there must be an element of risk there. There must be an element of risk for the organization. But also, I think it doesn't really make for great working practice. So the finding hasn't really changed. So Kevin, let's now look at competency frameworks. And this is, again, is another one of those big subjects, but let's just show the findings and hear what you want to say about that.
Yeah, so for me, it's number one, it's still disappointing that there isn't a competency framework for everyone. It also surprises me the proportion of people that don't know whether one exists or not. Because for me, a competency framework should be the thing that actually frames everything the MSL is doing. So it should be available to be used during the recruitment process, through onboarding, right the way through career development for the experienced MSL as well. I think we missed the trick, and we talked about this yesterday. We asked if there was a competency framework. We didn't ask how effective that competency framework was or how it's being used within the organisation. So again, when we come to look at MSL development in one of the later webinars, I think that's something that we need to explore further, because it's all very well to have them as some kind of dusty document that sits on the shelf, but they should be living and breathing documents or frameworks that actually help people achieve what they want to achieve in terms of their development, so that they aren't leaving organisations.
And I would like to add to this, and we just for the benefit of those of you who are on this call, we are having a webinar on the 17th of June on the subject of the evolving MSL role. And I would also argue that even if there is a competency framework, is it fit for purpose when we think about the evolving MSL role? Because we have defined four new competencies, or the four essential competencies, which we believe are essential for the evolving MSL. And so in the absence of perhaps there being clarity, and when we talk about competencies, we mean knowledge, we mean skills, and we mean behaviours. So in the absence of organisations really defining what those competencies are, it's then quite difficult to plan to support your MSLs in their evolution. Does that make sense, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Sharon's just commented that it would be interesting to know how many MSLs get to contribute to competencies, or who produces the guidance. And, you know, it's very easy for people sitting outside of any role to create a competency framework. But if it's going to work for the people that it affects, then they should be involved in the creation, or at least the testing of it, before it's rolled out. So thank you for saying that, Sharon. It's a great point.
So now we'll move on to onboarding. And a busy, busy slide. So please know that you can come back and interrogate this when we post them onto the community. But the question here is on the left-hand side. And you can see that 500 MSLs answered this question. So just for a moment, take in the scale of the responses and the topics that have been defined by MSLs as being important to their onboarding. And you can see on the bottom left that other included insights generation, pipeline, medical plan, and so on. So in other words, this is what MSLs believe they need to know so that they can be effective within their role. It's huge. And we are really very passionate about onboarding and design many onboarding programs for companies in terms of the journey. And when we see the findings such as this, it really brings about quite a lively conversation with organizations around duration of onboarding. We wanted in particular to call out the fact that this was the first year we had asked the question around the inclusion of the topic on the MSL as a strategic partner. And some of you may be saying, what on earth does that even mean? And but the reality is that 76% of respondents identified this as being important. So when we now move on to length of onboarding, the results are quite stark, because despite MSLs having given the responses they did, you can see that for more than 50%, their onboarding is 1 month or less. Now, you might all be saying, well, if I'm an experienced MSL, I will know most of what you've defined. I just need to sort of be familiar with the science. But But I would argue that really, in order for the organization to be confident that there is consistency and alignment around the standards, then onboarding needs to be longer than 1 month. It's a personal viewpoint. I'd be curious to know what those of you on the line are thinking. Then we asked a question about scientific knowledge review. So we're, you know, very often, and you will all know this, you know, that the onboarding with respect to science is largely self-directed. You know, you're provided with access to the data and to the resources. You might have some internal support, but it's largely self-directed. So how do we know that the MSLs are, in essence, fit for purpose? And these are the findings that we have uncovered. And I know, Kevin, that this is something that worries you to an extent. And it would be good, wouldn't it, to hear thoughts from people on the line. You know, do you believe that scientific knowledge review is essential before going live in field? But this is the reality. This is the reality of 424. The total cohort was 424. So that we know that, you know, for about 120 people,
yeah,
they didn't go through a scientific knowledge review.
And the thing that concerns me with this is we would never consider sending any commercial focused individual out without some kind of knowledge review. So that's number one. Number two, we're talking about the role of the MSL being to create partnerships with their external stakeholders, to become trusted partners. And the risk here, in terms of if we get the information that we share wrong in any way, we could have a direct effect on a patient, a cohort of patients. And therefore, we should be even more stringent in the measures that come. And it shouldn't just be about knowledge retention. It should be about how you verbalize that knowledge as well as part of a conversation, because those are two completely different things. And so I think it's something that really needs to be looked at, because I think there's a potential for risk to the company by not doing this.
And actually, yes, and so we've had two comments that have come in chat. Sharon is saying that within her organization, we assess way more than the science. And she said, you know, and this is echoed by both Maya and others. You know, if you do not get the science right, how will HCPs perceive you?
Exactly.
And it's, you know, people, I've often struggled with this idea of being a peer-to-peer, you know, of the MSL having a peer-to-peer relationship. I think that can be challenging unless you've been in an equivalent role. But nonetheless, you should be absolutely confident to be the expert on your product data. And that's where you have an opportunity. And if there's no means of assessing where you are around that conversation, then I'm afraid it's really hard to build credibility. And I know that sounds a bit harsh, but if you need support or need more time, I've certainly had situations where, you know, we've extended MSL onboarding because of the complexity of the data, because of the enormity of what it was we were asking people to be familiar with, so that they could feel more confident and so that they could go out and build those relationships. So, but you know, it wouldn't be a difficult thing to do to create some kind of a guidance document around how to conduct an end of onboarding review. You know, this is not rocket science, let's face it. So perhaps we'll pop that one onto the list of to-dos, Kevin. The very long list of to-dos. Okay, so Another interesting topic. Do you believe that onboarding should be supported by a mentor or experienced colleague? And I can hear those of you in the background screaming at the screen going, of course, of course. But yet, this is a reality. And, you know, for a third of people. So again, you know, this is huge. You know, if in particular, if you have entered, you know, into industry from healthcare or academia, it's such a different world to be part of. And in the absence of you having a mentor or a buddy to support you, that can be quite a tough experience. And Kevin, I think you want to say a few words about this term mentor and what that means.
So I think there's several things that we need to consider here. And again, you know, it's a bigger conversation than today. But the ability to be a mentor, so the role of a mentor is a great opportunity for development, which links back to the kind of earlier conversation. I think there's a risk, and the risk is here that someone is chosen to be a mentor based on their longevity. So I think a good mentor needs to want to be a mentor, number one. I also think that they need to be chosen on their abilities and their competencies, not on how long they've been in role. Because the role of a mentor is to help people understand their role in the real context. So they've done their training. They've now got this wise, experienced person that they can go to for help. So number one, the mentor needs to be at the top of their game from a knowledge perspective. So go back to the question in terms of having a knowledge review. And also, we would want them displaying the best skills, you know, kind of excellence in implementation of everything that we're asking of them, so that the new MSL, the one that's being onboarded, is learning best skills. It isn't that they aren't picking up the bad habits that someone who's just been in role for a long time might have. I'm not saying everyone would, but actually it's something that needs to be looked at in more detail rather than just the, Helen's been around for a while, I'll link Helen with Kevin and they'll get
ever,
fine.
Don't ever do that. Thank you. So let's now look at external engagement. So again, this is food for thought. This is intended to be provocative. So, and we know that the pandemic has really, to an extent, probably affected how people feel about answering this question, because for many countries, they're still just coming out of the pandemic. And at the point at which they answered this survey, they were probably still in the pandemic. So, what we can see here is that there was a slight drop off in terms of clarity on the amount of time. But then if we go to these KPIs and the amount of time you're expected to engage externally, and again, showing the results across both surveys, and we can see that 70% is the average, if we can call it that, in terms of the most, you know, that is as a KPI. And there are a number of organizations where clearly, and there's no difference there, where there are no measures in place. And this is actually a subject which I know causes huge debate within organizations. And I think that when we next look at we're going to show you some findings around the challenges that MSLs experience. And you can see that perhaps despite having these KPIs that have been defined, there are pressures internally that actually make this quite challenging. So it's food for thought for all of you. Looking at stakeholders, we can see that not all MSLs have a target number of stakeholders. And but what we are seeing is this, we're starting to see more of a diversity, a growth in the stakeholder groups that MSLs are engaging with. And of course, this will be influenced by where you're working in the drug life cycle, whether you're in rare disease or whether you're, you know, what the TA is that you're working in. There are a huge number of factors which influence this. But I think what this says to us is that, you know, if we consider that we might be working with anyone as an MSL, we might be engaging with all of these stakeholders. We, of course, know that each of these stakeholders we're engaging for different reasons, and that each of these stakeholders have different professional interests and different needs. And when we think about individualized engagement, it's really, really important that we are adapting our approach according to who it is that we are engaging with. You may not be surprised to see the findings on the left-hand side. Of course, there has been a massive increase in the use of virtual engagement. And I spoke yesterday at a conference on the subject of, being effective, ensuring that we could be effective in our remote engagement. And in fact, I argued that really the technology was just a very small part of success. But I think that we were curious and interested to see the WhatsApp finding. And so because that is something that we haven't seen previously and something that we, as I said, we are curious about. And that led us to thinking that we might ask a question. So here's another opportunity for you all to tell us. So in your organization, are there regulations around your use of social media and channels such as WhatsApp to engage with external stakeholders? So we just love to know. And thank you again for your honesty. If you're saying no, it's really great for us to know. But it's also good for those individuals to be aware that in other organizations there are regulations. Awesome. I would have expected that there would be, but of course we live in the real world. So thank you. Thank you, everyone. So yes, 88% of people saying yes. Impact and value, the usual. We're seeing here quantitative and qualitative metrics. What we also have called out here are the others, and you will see those within the One community. This was a finding about rating. How do you believe the MSL in your organization is seen? And you have the range here from service function to strategic business partner. So there is a growing shift towards the right-hand side, but clearly a number of organizations believe that they're still quite some way off being regarded as a strategic business partner. Key skills. We have here this huge variety of key skills again, and I'm sorry, I'm rushing because time has just moved on much faster than I thought. And we see here the top three needs here around key skills, insights, building trusted partnerships, and creating long-term engagement plans. And there are differences, and this is what we wanted to call out earlier, Kevin, wasn't it? That there is certainly, it's this group between 12 months and 3 years who are demonstrating this awareness of their skills needs. And again, we will probably explore this in a future webinar, that this tails off with time in role. And that again is an interesting debate. The importance of upskilling, 94% or more saying yes, it is. But actually, again, a quarter of MSLs not having access to upskilling programs within their organizations. This, I think, is quite shocking. Looking at the number of interactions MSLs have had where they have been observed by a manager, and the comment that came yesterday from the participants was that actually virtual engagement should make this, and I know you again, Kevin, believe very strongly in this. This is a given. This should be entirely possible. And yet, almost a third of MSLs had not a single interaction where they were observed by their manager in a previous 12 months. And in fact, to say that, you know, almost 60, just over 60% had three or less, I don't know what those of you who are on the line make of this, but I think this is really disappointing and really quite demotivating for the MSL. It's very difficult to know how it is that you're performing in the absence of any observed interactions or any feedback, which then leads us, Kevin, to, would you like to make a quick comment on this slide?
Yeah, again, the two things are inextricably linked, and they also link to this desire for development that people have, and yet they're not receiving. So it's thinking about what coaching is. So coaching isn't just being with someone and telling them stuff. It also isn't the, I'm going to spend 8 hours in the car with them. Coaching is the conversation that happens around the development area that someone has identified with the help of the manager or the coach, you know, where the manager isn't the one doing the coaching. And that needs to happen over time. So the fact that here we've got about 60% of people that have had three or less interactions with someone to talk about this in the previous 12 months suggests that it isn't happening, which then goes leads to that, well, they're then not being developed, which is why they're then leaving. So it's that if we follow this all the way through, there are some very clear indications about what organizations need to do in order to retain good people. And they're linked. We can't separate them out.
Absolutely. And there are comments on the line saying it would be great to dig further into this. We are not showing the manager's data as part of this webinar. We will do it as a separate webinar. But it's shocking to see that so many managers are in role in the absence of having any support to be a manager. And as Sharon pointed out, you know, you managers, in order to really be doing the right thing by their MSLs, need to be trained around the provision of feedback and coaching. But we'll not get in there because we'll never get Kevin off the subject because I know it's his passion. So career pathway, is it important that there is a career pathway? And again, some quite shocking findings, which this links back, I think, to the development, the reason for leaving. So we're now just going to come finally to look at challenges that MSLs say that they are facing in their role. And this is probably linked to the reality of the pandemic and what people have been experiencing. Because we know, my goodness, you know, that organizations have been determined to keep people busy. And so I think that the top two are, you know, we're all suffering from remote and virtual fatigue. But if you look at the bottom line here, the pressure to deliver on internal projects, which impacts on my ability to be externally facing. So this KPI thing is really complex. And you know, we've got the heavy workload and but, you know, for us, we have this whole piece in the middle about lack of time for upskilling. And that is something we feel really passionately about. And there are many takeaways. Look, you know, we've pulled out a few of the takeaways that really resonated with us. And I'm sure that for each one of you, you will be thinking about points that you are taking away. And of course, you'll all be familiar with our academy, and really our academy is part of our response to what we learn. It really helps us to create new material, to be more innovative in the way that we operate.
There are a couple of questions that we haven't closed off.
Okay.
I have put it in the chat. So Jodie actually asked, did we measure an average number per MSL? And this was in relation to time spent. So Jodie, I didn't know whether it was number of stakeholders per MSL or number of visits per MSL as a metric. So if you could clarify that for us, that would be good. No, we didn't actually measure number of stakeholders, did we?
But we have done previously, Jodie. So, yeah. Well, again, I think, Jodie, it depends on whether you're in rare disease or whether you're early in the drug life cycle. That would be quite an interesting analytic to do. So good. So some really, really interesting. They confirm most of what you're doing. That's always good to know, Alexandra. You're on the right track.
One of the other questions was, I think from Almudena, yeah. Do we intend to do anything else with the data? So the answer to that is yes, we will create a report that shows the full data set. But also we are considering writing a paper, aren't we, Helen, to kind of explore it in greater detail.
Yes,
because I think there's a lot to go at this time.
And I think what we will do is, if you feel, for those of you that are on the line, think if there's any one finding here that you think would make for a really interesting deep dive webinar, please do let us know, because we will be running our webinar series this year. If you'd like to be part of our webinar series, we're always looking for people who would like to join in. And we absolutely, we want to keep the conversation alive. You know, this is really, we really value this interaction with all of you. So despite having panicked that we were going to go over, it seems that we have managed to stop 3 minutes early. So a massive thank you to Greg for keeping me on track. He'll know what that means in the background. And to Kevin for his support as always. And to all of you for your participation, your engagement, and your comments and your questions. I'm keeping good MSL skill. You have no idea, Sharon.
If you want to start a conversation, Sharon, I'll talk to you later.
In the meantime, everyone have a wonderful weekend. And thank you again. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.